You're listening to my radio at stanpelke.com. Hello again, I'm Stan Pelke, your host at My Radio. In this second podcast, I will be continuing to read from Chapter 1 of my original science fiction novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. Please check back regularly for new content as well as additional podcasts. Charlotte's death unsettled Charlie. Someone had to be told the truth. Someone had to do something. But Charlie was not convinced that he should be or could be that someone. He returned to college after Charlotte's funeral, determined to work harder, to focus even more intently on his studies, and to put the memories of the ghostly being out of his mind once and for all. But it was harder said than done. The reality in the closing months of that fall were very different than what he intended. The station haunted his waking thoughts and his restless spirit. It pressed into his head. Worse, Charlie began to imagine that he saw the ghostly, faceless creature at his own college, in the evenings in the library around the book stacks, in the dining hall late at night, even in the sun-drenched grounds around the laboratory building. He could hardly sleep, and his grades dropped. He did not return to college after that first failed semester. Once more, Charlie tried to bury himself in his work, first on his ailing grandfather's struggling farm, then at one odd job after another. Still, the ghost followed him, haunted him, unnerved him. Not even the sleeping tablets that Dr. Gerhard finally provided him did any good. And so, step by step, day by day, Charlie's spirit had become convinced that he needed to know, once and for all, what was this creature and why did it pursue him? If he did not find answers, soon, his life would end, one way or another. How many nights had it been since Charlotte's funeral that he had not slept fitfully? If he tried, he might have been able to count them all. Charlie finally reached his breaking point a week earlier. His pace slackened and he came to a stop as he thought about that night. It was late Friday evening. Grandfather was dozing in his armchair near the fire, a book turned open across his left knee, his pipe smoking on the edge of an ashtray beside his right elbow. Charlie was sitting quietly across the room beside the radio, the volume turned low so that he could listen to the late evening news bulletins without disturbing his grandpa. The only light in the room came from the radio, the fire, and the antique lamp beside grandpa. Shadows flickered across the walls and over the ceiling. Charlie pulled an old quilt up closer around his shoulders. There was a draft in the room despite the fire. And then there was the sound of feet on the front porch, followed by a firm knock on the door. Grandpa stirred. "Who's making the racket at this hour?" "I'll go," Charlie said, pushing the quilt aside as he crossed the room and moved out into the foyer. He opened the door and found young Billy Clayton outside. "Charlie, it's Sherman, at the Flanagan." Billy bent over and gasped for air. He'd obviously run most of the way from downtown. "Sherman, what's up?" Charlie was already pulling a coat from the peg while he stuffed his feet into his boots. "Sherman," he heard Grandpa growl from the parlor. "I've had just about enough of that boy. Go knock some sense into him, you hear?" "What happened?" Charlie repeated. "Drank, then picked a fight. You know, the usual." They hurried down the front porch steps and dashed along the county road toward town. The wind was very chilly that early spring night. "Wish we could have taken your granddad's truck," Billy huffed. "No gas," Charlie replied. The 10-minute jog into town seemed to stretch on forever, especially as the night air got colder with each passing minute. It felt downright freezing as they approached the junction between the county road and Riverside Drive, which was nearly on the bank of the Salmon River. "Damn," Billy grunted, "it's worse than when I ran by the first time." They turned to the left and followed Riverside into the outskirts of downtown. Almost immediately, the unmistakable outline of the old station with its octagonal towers heaved up before them, blocking out the stars. "It's like the cold is creeping right up my legs," Billy sputtered. "What did you say?" Charlie said, clutching hold of Billy's arm and pulling him to a stop, just feet away from the entrance to the old Northside parking lot. "I said it feels like the cold is creeping right up my legs." "Let's find Sherman and get out of here," Charlie replied. Charlie led them to the left, toward the east of the station. It would have been faster to the Flanagan to pass along the right-hand side of the station, but Charlie was not going to go any closer than he had to. He was already scanning the windows below and above, as he always did, for signs of his ghost. As they rounded the corner and began to move along the south side of the station, the Flanagan now coming into view, a shadowy body plunged out from under the train station's covered passenger entranceway and hurled itself into them. "Sherman!" Billy croaked, nearly falling over. "You scared the tar out of me!" Sherman grabbed hold of the front of Charlie's coat. "Help me, Charlesy!" Charlie tried to steady his friend, who was unbalanced by both the alcohol he'd drunk and the panic he was obviously feeling. "Sherm, steady on. We gotta go. We gotta go now. The man with the cape, he's following me." Sherman tried to run again, but he was in such bad shape from drinking and fighting that he tripped over his own feet and pulled Charlie down with him. They landed hard on the gravel on the edge of Main Street. Sherman struggled to get back up, kicking Charlie twice in the shin as he tried to stand. Hey, easy, just a second. "Get off," Sherman yelled. "We gotta go, it's gonna kill us. There's no one there. He's right there, in the doorway." Sherman tried to push himself up again, couldn't, started to crawl frantically along the pavement, then yelled, "I can't move my legs, help me, Charlesy." He collapsed completely again. "It's so cold," he stammered. Charlie staggered up, but he too felt the unmistakable, unearthly cold creeping up his legs. "Billy, help me pick up Sherman." There was no reply. Charlie turned this way and that, but Billy was gone. Charlie swore, looked back into the darkness under the covered entranceway, then grabbed Sherman's shoulders, pulled him up, and slung him over his shoulders. There was no way he was going to get Sherman back to his grandfather's farm like this, and no way he was going to take Sherman back to his own house. Not after another drunken fight. Sherman's father was apt to beat them both. He had only one choice. Charlie started to carry Sherman toward the Flanagan. The hotel and the station were less than 100 feet apart, yet it felt like the longest walk of his life. Charlie's legs seemed to grow less and less responsive with each step. He did not dare to look back, but he was certain someone was watching him, staring into his back, into his very soul, from one of those darkened windows. All the while, Sherman whimpered and muttered in his ear, "There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to hide. He's always watching, always watching. He sees me, always." "There's no one there," Charlie replied, but he did not believe himself. Somehow, Charlie managed to reach the hotel, climb the front stairs, and get through the door. He had just enough money in his coat pocket to get a room for the night. He was lucky that his grandfather was on good terms with the owner. So despite Sherman's latest fight in the hotel's tavern, the two young men were soon safely behind a locked door on the second floor. There they slept, Sherman soundly in the bed covered with nearly every blanket in the room, Charlie fitfully in a chair by the window, shivering. Each time he woke, Charlie was sure he caught a glimpse of a featureless head slip away into the deeper darkness beyond the window in the second story of the station, just across the way from their room. Since that horrible night with Sherman, Charlie had tried to build up his courage to return to the station. 3 times he had made it to the corner of Riverside Drive and Main, right to the front of the station. And then as he stood staring at that dark entranceway, his nerves had gotten the best of him, and he would turn and race home. But not tonight. Here he was again, wandering back to the old haunted place, determined to break in, determined not to care whatever the repercussions. It had not been difficult to find loose boards barely securing an old service entrance on the far western side of the station, closest to the Flanagan. Regardless of its reputation, thrill seekers regularly broke into the station, eager to seek the ghost or to have a safe place to drink in the dead of night. The remnants of their parties were strewn all across the floor of the first room beyond the door. It had once been a storage room, but all the valuables and most of the shelving were long gone. Charlie lit his flashlight. A rat squeaked and bolted from the circle of light. Several roaches scurried away along the windowsill to his right. Inches of dust clung to what was left of the light fixtures on the walls, and cobwebs fluttered all around. Charlie Spear's heart was racing. He could feel his own pulse in the side of his neck as his adrenaline-drenched blood raced upward toward his head. And he imagined that he might have seen his chest thumping in and out uncontrollably if he had not been bundled up by a heavy sweater and grandfather's tweed sports coat. "It's not too late to go home," he whispered into the darkness. "No, I need to know. I have to know. I cannot go on like this." He clenched his fists and defiantly set his jaw, willing himself to move forward. Just then, Charlie heard a noise ahead, like feet scampering into the deeper darkness beyond the reaches of his flashlight's feeble illumination. Hello? Who's there? More sounds of footsteps going further away. Maybe he should leave and come back another night. Maybe he should go get that stupid Billy Clayton who had hidden himself away for the past 6 days. Maybe he should just go home. Then there were voices far into the gloom, and without even deciding, Charlie dashed forward. His hair was growing damp from anxiety and nervousness, though the air inside the abandoned station was uncommonly chilly. He exited into the main lobby just in time to see feet running just out of the circle of light and toward the platforms. Hey, wait a minute! What are you guys doing in here? I just want to talk to you! But no one answered him. All he heard was the sound of feet, and many more of them than he'd first thought he had heard or imagined possible. Even in the dim light cast by his aging flashlight, Charlie could see that the lobby floor was filthy. Rags, broken wooden chairs, and old newspapers were crumpled in every corner. Beer cans had been tossed about everywhere. He started to run after the receding footsteps and tripped on the back of a broken bench that seemed to reach up off the ground for him. He fell hard onto the marble floor and lost his grip on the flashlight. It hit the floor with a loud clatter, shut off, and rolled away. Charlie tasted blood dripping from where his front teeth had dug into his lips as he landed on the cold marble floor. As he tried to stand back up, he groaned out loud from the pain in his left ankle. He had twisted it badly when he fell. There was no hope of finding the flashlight in the dark, but now he was not sure which way he'd come, and in that moonless night, the lobby was nearly pitch black. "Hey, this isn't funny!" he yelled into the darkness. "I've lost my light and twisted my ankle." Nothing. "Come on, please, I just need a little help here." Nothing. No, not nothing. A strange, raspy sound close by, like labored breathing and getting closer, and the sound of a foot dragging slowly behind a heavy body. Unexpectedly, a sudden burning sensation, a mixture of defiance and smoldering hatred, surged through his body. Charlie turned toward the sound. "Damn you," he yelled into the darkness. "I've been waiting for you." "And I you." The voice was icy and seemed to echo all around him. Charlie choked on his own defiance. The raspy breath drew closer, and then a hand, invisible in the dark, clutched hold of his twisted ankle. Charlie yelped in surprise, then instinctively tried to kick himself free. The weight of a body, still invisible in the dark, began pressing down on both his ankles, then his calves, and it was inching closer to his chest. The rasping grew louder. The faintest hint of breath slid across his cheek and down his neck. Indistinct whispering filled his head, and he began to shiver right down into the very bottom of his soul. With inhuman strength, Charlie rolled to his left, onto his hip, still sore from the tumble a week before, and pulled himself free. He rose, grunting from the pain in his ankle as he got onto both feet, and shaking with feelings of rage and dread, which crowded out every rational thought, Charlie's spear began to run. For a moment, the raspy breathing and dragging leg seemed to become more distant, but then as suddenly the sounds were coming from in front of him, he was running right back into the cold arms of his childhood nemesis. He turned toward the left, tripped on a bottle, pulled himself up, hit his head on a ledge, and stumbled on. That must have been a ticket counter, he thought, rubbing his head, his mind suddenly lucid again. If he kept going forward, he'd end up on the platforms, and perhaps then he would find a way out. Raspy breath seemed to be all around him now. "We gotta go, it's going to kill us, but there's no one there." Those were the words he and Sherman had exchanged a week before, but they were said in his own voice. No, Charlie had actually yelled them into the darkness without thinking, and he did so again. Animal instincts now kicked in and reason retreated. Charlie Spear ran and ran. Yet it seemed to be in circles, and the cold hands and deadly breath were always only inches away. The corpse head loomed up before him, illuminated by an inner light of pale blue and yellow. Teeth nearly black with decay chomped in the limpid jaw as the specter muttered meaninglessly. Eye sockets, long empty, burned with a cold, hate-filled fire. Bony hands reached for Charlie's shoulder to pull him into a death embrace. "Who are you?" Cold like he'd never known before began to creep from the bony hands into his shoulders and down his chest toward his heart. Charlie knew that when that cold touched his heart, he would die. "Who are you? Who are you?" the thing cackled back in a distorted version of Charlie's own voice. Without thinking, Charlie drove his forehead into the specter's limpid, toothy jaw. One bony hand shot up and off his left shoulder as the spectral creature stumbled backward from the unexpected blow. Blood ran down into Charlie's right eye from a cut made by the blackened teeth. He twisted to his left and pulled himself free of the other spectral hand. And he was falling. Somehow, he'd made his way onto a platform after all. But now he had stepped too far to his left and was tripping headfirst off the platform's edge and down the 5 feet to the rail bed below. Only it was not 5 feet. Inexplicably, the space had grown, was growing, would always grow. Charlie Spear was looking down into a gorge, the rails hundreds of feet below. No, an abyss. The rails had become invisible to human eyes, an entire star system below him. Just before Charlie keeled over completely, the bony spectral hand caught hold of the tweed sports coat and held him fast. His feet on the edge of the platform, Charlie's back was now leaning out precariously toward a galactic gorge. The young man looked first at the death-illuminated face, then down into the star-filled vacuum. It had been a crystal-clear night with only a new moon to dim the lights of the stars. Every one of them had appeared, the entire panoply of heavenly lights, and now the whole universe was opening up beneath him. Charlie Spear was no longer in a train station. He was trapped on the very edge of an incomprehensibly huge galaxy, held in place by one inexplicable monstrosity, while another monstrous, wretched emptiness at the center of the galaxy below him pulled with irresistible force at his body, his mind, his soul. Charlie looked back into the fiery eyes and felt an equally inexplicable peace. "Please don't let go of me." There was no reply. Man and monster were poised in perfect balance. A minute? An hour? A lifetime? And then the ghost pushed Charlie Spear away. Charlie was tumbling now, head over heels into an impossible night sky filled with soaring lights and twisting comet trails and blue-green planets. And all around in every direction that his eyes darted, the spectral head floated in space, watching him plummet. He could now see that monstrous darkness at the heart of the galaxy yawning open for him. He closed his eyes and steeled himself to be swallowed whole by the angry universe. "Hold on!" Charlie's eyes snapped open. The black-gloved hand had grabbed hold of his twisted and pain-filled ankle. Squatting there on the edge of the platform, the helmeted figure was trying to pull him back up onto the safety of the concrete ledge. "Give me your hands! Don't let go of me! I'll fall into the darkness! Give me your hands! I can't hold on forever!" Charlie's body was unnaturally cold. He could not rotate his arms back over his dangerously inclined body and toward the helmeted stranger's waiting left hand. "Give me your hands! I can't hold on forever! No, wait! Behind you! Look out!" It was too late. The spectral creature loomed up again from the darkness, and with superhuman strength, it swung a broken iron bar into the helmeted head. The stranger cried out with shock and pain and anger, and his helmet flew off his head. As Charlie Spear slipped away, plummeting back into the darkest darkness of his darkest night, he saw his own face looking back at him from the edge of the platform, just before the spectral beast consumed his would-be black-clad rescuer. The spectral light went out. The stars vanished. There was no more.
This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.